Cages, Dragon Child, and Faraway Ghost at Millennium Stage, April 4th. Diggable Planets, Sun Ra Orchestra, and more at the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam, April 7th. Plus, Poetry Slams, a hip-hop education conference, and free dance workshops all week. To learn more about all the events, visit wblinc.org/WBLFest.
Welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM out of Washington, D.C., Pacifica Foundation Radio on your dial, also on WPFWFM.org. This is the Hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and being part of the Jazz and Justice radio team for more than 46 years, due to you, the listeners, supporting this station, we are virtually entirely supported by you, the listener, and it's your financial wherewithal and social connectivity that we're very much grateful for. This is a week where we commemorate and to some degree memorialize the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It is important to remember and hold dearly and act upon all that he offered the world. To help us do that, we're going to look at Meditations on Martin and Forming Democracy. Our guest is historian Randall Maurice Jelks. He is the Ruth N. Halls Professor of African American and Africa Diaspora Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington. He's also a descendant of the Georgetown 272. Dr. Jelks is the author of four books, African Americans in the Furniture City, The Struggle for Civil Rights in Grand Rapids, Benjamin Elijah Mays, Schoolmaster of the Movement, a biography, Faith and Struggle in the Lives of Four African Americans, Ethel Waters, Mary Lou Williams, Eldridge Cleaver, and Muhammad Ali. And what's fueling this conversation is his book, Letters to Martin, Meditations of Democracy in Black America. I should additionally tell you that he is a documentary film producer and has produced and contributed to Langston's Lawrence, Garden City, Kansas, as well as a documentary with Academy Award winner Kevin Willmott on Langston Hughes. Dr. Jelks, welcome.
Thank you.
And it's with pleasure, full disclosure, that I know you as a minister, a speaker, a teacher, and a documentarian. It's really a pleasure to know all four of those modalities in the totality of yourself, sir.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, David. We've known each other a while now, so blessings on to that.
Well, without further ado, it is often compelling to encounter Martin Luther King. It causes us to have many responses. Why did you come about doing this meditation, and what do you hope to achieve with this book offering?
I was asked to speak at Elmhurst University, was once known as Elmhurst College, just outside of Chicago, on the King Day, after the President Trump was elected to the presidency. And as I was approaching this, I was thinking, well, what would I say to students who weren't alive almost, 50 plus years ago when King was assassinated? And what students want to know is the real, so, or the intimate. So I decided to, as it's talk, to write it as a letter. What would I write to Dr. King about today's times and what was going on? And students really resonated with it. And from there, I said, let me continue this and let me think this through and let me put this in some kind of book form. It allowed me to sort of put history, my own history, culture together to, as though I was writing King about what was going on the things that occurred long after his death.
And what better way to be properly beholden to someone who's such an inspiration and mobilizer? I don't use that word accidentally, by the way. We'll find out more about that in the interview. Before we continue, too, you mentioned that you're bringing yourself into this project. It's obvious from what you said that it's an offering of your experiences and perspectives. What does it mean to be part of the Georgetown 272? Can you explain that to listeners?
Yes. Georgetown University sold out of their plantation in Maryland, down the block. You're in the DMV, so you know what that means. And they sold slaves to keep the university open, and they sold them into Louisiana. And that's where I was born. I was born in New Orleans, and my younger cousin Tristan decided that he would take the test for many reasons. And I said, Tristan, I don't know. And he did. And it sort of pinged all over the place. The university contacted me because I'm a historian. And I also know Josh Rothman over at Georgetown, whose class had worked on this project. And he said jokingly, "I knew, Jelks, you were going to pop up in this thing." And surprisingly, I did. A great-great-great-grandmother and her baby were sold in Louisiana, along with a whole host of people. On my maternal grandfather's side. And they were all out of a little town called Gray, Louisiana. Lafourche Parish, all those places I had been as a child, going with my grandparents to their homes or church events or whatever else was going on. So that is real significant that I'm in university life, a descendant of a university that sold my ancestors into Louisiana, and that was called being sold down the river. And they were literally sold down the river. And my great-great-grandmother, Harriet, that name has stayed in our family. So that's very meaningful.
Yeah. You're also a child and product of the Great Migration, winding up in Chicagoland as well. And I'll just give you the bridge right now so you can go ahead. So we have childhood spent in observing Dr. King, possibly through our communities or on the television, hearing snippets of speeches. And importantly, I think as Black folk, we're mindful that a quota snatched tier, a romanticization is created there. There's what some writers and commentators have called the Santa Clausification of Dr. King, or an extreme hagiography, an idolization that doesn't really truly do Dr. King justice. I wonder if you want to respond to any of that.
Well, yes, that's all of that's true. And you know, I begin this book with the one of the first critical evaluations of King by John A. Williams, who was a novelist, in the book The King That God Didn't Save. And it was on my uncle's, he had a little library and he was in there, and I just started thumbing through it. And I was shocked because I saw this picture of Andrew Young and Martin King, and Dr. King had a cigarette and he was slumped over. And it just like, oh my God, this man's human. It's not the Ebony magazine, Dr. King, saintly, pure. And he didn't allow people to smoke. And that's one of the few photographs you'll see him with a cigarette in his hand, exhausted roughly around 4 a.m. at the Birmingham airport. And so I began to think about these kinds of questions. And you said of the Great Migration. Yes, my mother and I came to Chicago the last year, 1970, the last year of the Great Migration from New Orleans. No, I did not ride the train. We actually flew to Chicago and joined one of my mother's older brothers there. And it was the last year, and it was Chicago with 1 million Black people, quite different than New Orleans, because it was the feel was quite different. So, yes, I am the child of the Great Migration, the last year, by the way. 1970,
yeah. Last year. So we talked about that there's been an ever-evolving context that has really, hopefully not transmuted Dr. King, but something that we have to navigate through. I wonder if you could read from your book, from page 28, maybe the two paragraphs that we set up, the last paragraph and going into the next page of the first. This will give readers and listeners a sense of the context that we're in and what we're struggling with.
Hi, I'm Jackie Lupemon.
Peace, I'm Sean Blackman, and we're the hosts of Darker Than Blue, your number one source for struggle, socialism, soul.
We explore people's movements, news, politics, music, and culture from a perspective that you won't hear from the bought and paid for corporate media.
This is a show by the movement and for the movement. So we don't just want you to listen. We want you to get involved in the effort to change the world for the better.
So check us out every Friday at 5 p.m. beginning January 5th on Pacifica Radio's WPFW.
Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. We had a brief technical difficulty in this age of technology. Sometimes Zoom connections don't always work as they should. I asked Dr. Randall Jelks, a historian, who's talking about Meditations on Martin. That's Martin Luther King Jr., the Reverend Doctor, who continues to leave us a legacy for the struggle of freedom. And we were talking about how changing context challenged us to properly embrace Dr. King and act upon what he offered the world. Dr. Jelks, if you can go ahead, please, and give us a sense of the world that we're in.
Yes, this is from a chapter called The Highest Ethical Ideals. And I write, in today's world, there's an unwilling, there's a willful undermining of democratic institutions by sundry political leaders, from clergy to elected officials. Democracy as an inner value of human dignity is all but forgotten. Too many politicians have grown impatient with the process. of haggling and negotiating that democracy requires. Too many religious leaders hold to a narrow zealotry about whose faith is pure and whose is not. Too many business leaders have drunk the hemlock of efficiencies, spreadsheets, and profit maximization rather than long-term investments. And too many spiritual leaders view the spirit as a tool to manipulate large followings instead of a way of inculcating wise principles of community building. Contemporarily around the globe, the militarized strongmen, the uniform party, and the giant corporate conglomerate override our deliberations. This is not something new. Slavery and U.S. imperial democratic governance from its inception. What is different, perhaps, is that globally we are being fooled into believing that efficient distribution of consumer goods is equivalent to being democratic. Surely one must realize that brand loyalty does not help to deliver or govern ourselves. Tragically, being a citizen is too often conflated with consumerism. Government is viewed as a delivery service, not a deliberative body of social good. What is worse is the marketing of fear. The consistent stampede of moral panics is worldwide. Fear mongering works. And the more we fear, the more we are convinced to run into the embrace of authoritarian leaders rather than self-governing collectively.
So the implication to your reading is that to secure democratic ideals, and more properly put, to secure democracy, and even further put, to have a multiracial democracy, both here in the United States and worldwide, we have to be meditative, that we have to have a number of elements that Dr. King told us about, a revolution of values that is pursued by prayerful meditation. And I'd like Dr. Jelks to explain that. We're again running into some technical difficulty. If the air control could give us a brief break. Okay. And he'll be back with us in just a moment.
I'm so sorry.
That's quite all right. Dr. Jelks, did you happen to hear the question
you repeated this again.
Yeah, given what you've read in this time of tumult and confusion, I was kind of reiterating an argument that we're both familiar with, that having a moral compass or having clarity in a moral direction is quite difficult in the pursuit of freedom and democracy. And of course, Dr. King realized Black people represent that. And it's... the times have its troubles. They seem to be more extended than ever. So what does it mean to pursue democracy? This is the larger question of your book. Meditatively, reflectively, prayerfully.
First of all, I think most people have to make a decision. I can't tell you my spirituality is born of Christian practice. That's where it comes from. So in the larger Abrahamic tradition of equality before we are all equal in God's eyes. What it means is that everybody has to decide wherever their, whatever they call faith or whatever they call the spirit, is that they have to decide to be democratic. And many of us utter that in lip service, but in formal practice, we overrun people, we try to silence people, And it's important that we make a decision about internally that we are going to treat first people as human beings, no matter how much we disagree, that they have humanity, that they have a right to voice their disagreement, even if I don't want to hear it. And those are really, really important things that we as individuals have to do collectively. Then we have to come and protect and the rights of others. So just as we want our rights protected, so in a sense, we all have to be the ACLU of in our own internal lives.
Well, that's quite provocative in one regard. One can argue that, again, we don't have an agreed moral compass, a moral guide, and that we are indeed different. And people will question whether we approach either with goodwill or good intent. And certainly there's a chaotic world that demonstrates that this is not a mild observation by any means. You draw on, and we're not going to neglect really talking about Dr. King directly, but you draw upon, again, this notion throughout all these letters, which, by the way, the characteristic of having a collection of letters is you want to, the reader wants to read and reread them and look at what you're saying and what you're trying to convey from Dr. King. Again, I want to push the argument. We're being sold on a certain notion of Dr. King, and it seems very much an add-on. It doesn't seem like there's moral traction, a sense of common agreement, a sense of commonality.
Well, I mean, people like to cherry pick, right? King offered so many speeches, speeches on labor. Very few people quote any of his speeches on labor or to labor unions.
For instance, if you don't mind, all labor is of value. Yeah. It's translated into the commemoration of Dr. King is a day for volunteerism without very much attachment substantively to what Dr. King was saying about labor.
Right. That's
without
right.
I'm talking about Memphis or the sanitation.
Well, he started this conversation with labor long before Memphis. This was just the he had begun having conversations with labor unions. Working people needed protections. The people who went to his church, Ebenezer, weren't all of the highfalutin. They were the people who worked for others. And so he was very much mindful of labor. And he had spent time as a college student working up in Connecticut, with working people, making money over the summer. So it very much clued into that labor unions protected people, advanced their interests over against a large conglomerate. And so the kind of ideas that people take is, you know, they want to say, oh, my, I want to be judged by the content of my character. You know, Shelby Steele, almost 30 plus years ago, wrote this, you know, this book about content of our character. And I would say that's, but the first part of I Have a Dream is that the United States has given its black citizen a bounce check, insufficient funds. So these economic questions of democracy very much come through Dr. King as they did others before him.
We're talking to Dr. Randall Jelks. Dr. Jelks is a historian, and he's the Ruth Hall and Hall's Professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. We're entitling the show Meditations on Martin, Informing Democracy. What do we learn and embrace from the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that really supplies democracy? How do black people be the representation and the moral agents to secure this? You're listening to We the People, and your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Dr. Jelks, again, thank you for being with us. We're going to come up on a break shortly. What I want to do is capitalize on some of the touch points in an earlier question before we got interrupted with our connection. I was asking you, what did Dr. King mean by a revolution of values?
Well, again, he thought that we had to look at the ethical values that we hold dear. Is profit making the most money? Do we judge the skills of our great basketball players solely by their checks? Are we judging them by something else? And this is the kind of University of Chicago School of Economics that money is the all end and all be determinant of who we are. Which Dr. King came out of a very pluralistic Black community. And I say this, Black people have been practicing democracy long before they even got civic freedoms among themselves. We knew that there were different groups within our communities. We knew that there were, we had our arguments and share, and we had our live and let live attitude. That is a sense of democracy. And what I really wanted to point out is that Dr. King came out of a really Black sense of democracy, a Black American sense of democracy, that where we have an sort of inscribed tolerance one another, unless we are trying to ape our white brothers and sisters in the evangelical world or otherwise, but very much profoundly. The Auburn Avenue that he grew up in Atlanta had all kinds of different stripes of people. And that is an important thing, that the practice of democracy really was in the heart of Black communities itself.
Again, we're talking to Dr. Randall Jelks, historian. We're talking about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and what he offers to us in securing a multiracial democracy and the role that Black people have played in that. You're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. We've reached the halfway point of our show, and in service to you, we bring you public service announcements. But I ask you to stay with us while we join our conversation. Dr. Jelks will find out about this we-ness that Black scholars have observed about Dr. King after we come back.
Born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with island flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
Thank you again for being with us. And as you're rejoining us, I'm going to ask you to really clear up something about this practice of democracy that you described before the break. And again, listeners, I apologize. Dr. Jelks will rejoin us in a moment. But we are going to talk about what I alluded to during the break as the we-ness that Black scholars have observed when they examine the political challenges that Black folks have faced and the role of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King in securing it. Dr. Jelks, thank you for being back. I alluded before the break that you were going to explain to us what this concept of community of we-ness means among Black folk.
Yeah, well, and I wanted to re-examine Dr. King's last speech and said, we as a people will get there. And what just who were the people and who were, the, you know, we as a people will get there.
Memphis.
Yeah.
April Memphis. 3rd.
April 3rd, 1968. Yes. So the examination is that we don't, in the United States, we don't talk in collectives anymore. We are solely, so we get so individuated. But he's obviously saying we as a collective will get there. And so what is exactly that we-ness means in today's today's world, and that's and do we have a weakness? I mean, do we have class inequality? We have in your region of the world, we got a lot of well off people. Do they consider themselves in weakness with people who live in Southwest D.C.? So these are kinds of consideration, because King is obviously believing that there's a black community and that collectively they will get to the promised land. And so I wanted to examine what that weakness meant, especially so many of us are filled with languages of being on our own, being individuals, but not part of a collective.
Well, when it comes to leveraging and securing not only basic civil rights, but human dignity, the full humanity of things, again, one would argue that Dr. King was able to leverage some sense of conscience. It goes without saying that this level of consciousness is not the same, especially if you're an oligarch who might control 30% of the food supply by one family. Or if you're one of five families out in the West that control 20% of the available water supply. Or, well, we can go on and on. But the point is, there are people who have always been around who don't want the we-ness.
Correct, you know. but sort of like in Marx, I mean, and the dialectic, right? I mean, you've created an opposition, and the history of enslavement created its own opposition, right? It took people who were very different, from spoke different languages off the African continent, and reshaped them into a sense of a collective, particularly in the United States. In ways that were in the English speaking Caribbean, in ways that were different. So yes, there is a sense of we-ness if one is attached to a past history, if one is attached to the region of the world that one grew up in. There is a sense of we-ness, and he wanted to tap into that very much so to mobilized to expand the kind of human rights that were going on. But there is a worry that by many scholars, from philosopher Tommy Shelby to and others, about whether there is some such thing as a collective. And, you know, that's from the halls of the academy. But I do think that there's a sense of we-ness. And we have to cultivate that. The more,
for instance, how does that cross generations?
Yeah, well, the moral consciousness of it. I think, you know, Black Lives Matter. I mean, I think people understood the kind of moral that the policing had reached a point once again in U.S. history. This is cyclical, of doing murderous things in public. So that draws moral consciousness.
So one part of the population's acclimated, and they know how to react or posture or have a reactive response. Another part of the population, young people in particular, are self-directive, very inclusive, and mobilize. And right. You have the continuity. It's not wrong, especially if we're seeking to embrace Dr. King and all he's taught us and all he wants to inspire us to,
Well, the difficulty of mobilizing and keeping mobilizing going is sheer economics, right? I mean, people got to get paid. I mean, and I don't mean like when we say on the street, I got to get paid, you know, but they have to have enough money to have a roof over their head. And mobilizing is a challenge to that. You get foundation funds initially, you get this and that. But the long-term strategy is how do I get paid to keep building a democratic movement? And that's been the trickiest part. You have institutions such as the NAACP, the Urban League, but they have not been able, particularly the NAACP, with its illustrious history, has not been able to generate and mobilize people to hit the streets repeatedly. They can lobby, but those other things are really, really what's needed. And that's the hardest part. I mean, King and those were able to, and I say inclusively, for 13 years to mobilize from 55 to 68, mobilize people. But it was exhausting. It was fatiguing. And I would argue that he would have burned out if he'd continued without being assassinated. It was simply the sheer amount of being on the road, trying to raise money, giving yet another talk, going to yet another dinner, would have literally burned the man out.
But yet he realized that what he called a network of mutuality. In fact, there are many unsung people, particularly Black women, who really kept the movement and still keep the movement going on a functional day-to-day, I hate using this word, but I will, quotidian level. It's what you're identifying is a gap. I don't know if it's that quite problematic. You probably have more to say, but there's a gap. And I mean, Dr. King addressed this. I mean, again, people abstract a phrase, the drum major instinct. That's Dr. King talking about the nature of leadership.
Yeah, well, the kind of ongoing work is being done every day. You're absolutely right. People and communities all, and I really thank heavens for that. Everywhere there's just work being done. It doesn't get the media attention. It doesn't get the cameras. It doesn't get the great space on whatever 60 Minutes. But every day people are out here, particularly Black women and men, out here doing things that are important to sustain the lives of their communities and the dignities of the community. And that's the work that has to go on. While I chose to write these letters to Martin, I could have chosen to write these letters to Black America, but I think people know who Martin King was. And so I wanted to make sure that they got read. David, I just see the work is ongoing, and it's a day-to-day struggle. It's not a one-time, as Angela Davis might put it, one-time event. And then we got the revolution when I was a youngster. You know, when the revolution comes, the revolution is the day-to-day struggle.
So you're mentioning many touch points. Let me begin with this. You could have written a letter to Black America. Well, in particular, you could have written it to Malcolm, or you could have written it to Ella, as in Ella Baker, or Fannie Lou Hamer, or Bayard Rustin, and so on and so forth. There's a sense where people, even when you mention these figures with their being very much the person and fellow human of with other people, being on the ground rather, I'm sorry. All these people had a tremendous power that's identified by a love ethic, at least through the eyes of Dr. King. And again, I think it's mocking in this day and age that somehow this strength to love, one of the most powerful concepts, in fact, under the influence of Dr. Benjamin Mays and Howard Thurman, the contrast is one of distortion. What King represents to any of us who spend time examining him and trying to understand him and embracing him is the sense of the strength to love and to do things out of that love is not the same in this day and age.
Well, I mean, most, as I write in the book, in a chapter about strength to love, most of the world works on hate, shame and hate. And those are the two things that galvanize people more than anything. And fear, or as Howard Thurman calls it, the three hellhounds of hell is the three hounds of hell are, you know, fear, hypocrisy, and hatred. And so it's incumbent on us to examine all those things in our lives and face up to them. And that was the great thing about the civil rights movement. People could examine their fears and face up to them, and collectively they could do something about it.
Now, why meditation and prayerful?
Yeah, meditation helps you to take the long view, not the short view. It helps you, meditations are not just religious meditations. I mean, you know, great Roman political leaders wrote meditations. Everybody wrote meditations.
But how does Dr. King, for instance, what is the King imperative?
The King imperative is to, one of the things that you should take away from King is he's very thoughtful. That there are no quick gotcha answers. They are thoughtful answers, even when people were trying to beat gotcha questions. And I think we would all do well to take some time and figure out how to answer the questions before us all over the place. That there are no simplistic answers, but there are better answers than others. There is something better than Jim Crow, you know. There are no simplistic answers, but there's something better than Jane Crow. There are no simplistic answers, but we have to keep asking ourselves about who is managing power and who is not.
And it's the triplet of racism, materialism, and militarism that Dr. King so strongly referenced. We sit here in a world where there's a whole mass of a population squeezed into what was initially twice the size of the District of Columbia. Now it's the size of the District of Columbia, 2 million people who are cut off from food, water, medications. The resultant of a counter response of a horrible, atrocious killing and kidnapping of people who are not primarily involved. Go ahead. Situation.
Present, David, in our present situation, Dr. King was a prophet to the state. The state of Israel is a state. And That is, it's a governing body with its own self-interest and power dynamics. And somebody has to speak to that state within the among Israelis and among Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, quickly, can I point out something, even with that remark? I'm sorry. The Western industrial powers, whether people like it or not, have one position. Two-thirds of the rest of the world see things differently.
Correct.
And also, and I as indelicate as one might find it, do people really know each other? It seems to me like there's a sense of one group of people just being represented as numbers, totally abstract, without any true meaningful contact or relationship with other groups of people.
Well,
and I've abstracted it, but I think you certainly...
Yeah, there's a certain point of view, we could argue longer about that at some other point. But in relationship to Dr. King, these were the warnings and that he offered about Vietnam. These were the same issues about Vietnam that he tried to address in Beyond Vietnam at Riverside Church. These ideas of racism, as you already put it, racism.
Materialism.
Militarism. And militarism are with us. And people take sides, governments take sides. They decide who are allies in this, or they always are making sides. So we have to continue to press our own government about expanding the view about who has rights in the world, because racism has dictated so much of your U.S. foreign policy. Of course, we could. The simplest way to see that is South Africa 60 years ago. The U.S. foreign policy sided with the white minority rule, going against its own principles. So this is a continuation, and this is also a challenge to expand and change U.S. foreign policy. And just for the sake of argument, and I'll end here, my only trouble with that is that while the Israelis are going on, nobody's paying attention in Sudan to what is going on in Darfur. And so I'm often saying that these are collective human rights abuses, but when they happen on the African continent, it seems that everybody's very quiet about these things. When they have in Eastern Congo, in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, everybody's quiet about them. So we are still a sort of a Eurocentric kind of perspective on foreign policy.
Well, again, in talking to you in the last few minutes, Dr. Jelks, this tension between like this overarching engine of ideology versus, again, what Dr. King offered, and I am noticing how there's a mocking sense of you can't be meditative, you can't prayerfully pursue stuff, you can't force a conversation in the public square about human dignity. And certainly in these chaotic times, just about, what is it, a quarter to half of the world is going to have elections. And the commonplace, which is not integral in my opinion, about whether democracies will survive, is before us.
Well, those are by the very institutions that we built and we protect or we reformed. So we need to do all kinds of institutional reform and to protect one another. Unless we open sheer chaos, we are creatures of institutions, not just of ourselves. And so we have to do our best to keep building institutions such as Howard University and that trains students. But we also have to build institutions why we need to participate in governing and always keep our eye out for the uses and abuses of power.
So somehow there's a mercy to have a strength to love, to take care of oneself and others, I imagine.
That's yes. There's King saw love as a form of power. And I think that is that's key here, that it wasn't just abstraction. It wasn't romantic love. And it was a form of power. It was a form, ways to mobilize by seeing the humanity of even your enemy. Love your enemy. Not saying you don't have enemies. Love your enemy. Do not dehumanize your enemy.
What a powerful challenging word to end on.
Yeah.
Again, my thanks to you, Dr. Randall Jelks. Again, Dr. Jelks is a historian. We've been fueling this conversation, Meditations of Martin, Informing Democracy, from his latest book, Letters to Martin, Meditations on Democracy in Black America. Dr. Jelks, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me as well.
That brings the conclusion of this episode of We the People. Coming up next is the news brought to you by Sue Goodwin, and at the noontime hour, don't forget the blues with Clarence the Blues Man Turner.
Listening to the just completed program. If you'd like to offer feedback on any of our programming, please email us at info@wpfw.org.
WPFW must move by December 2024 and will be hosting a series of events and presenting special programming to raise the funds necessary for our new home. We kick off these efforts Saturday through Sunday, April 6th and 7th, with Jazz is the Teacher, Funk is the Preacher, 2 days of programming dedicated to the jazz and funk idioms. From the searing riffs of the J.B. Horns, to Les McCann's soulful piano comping, to the Art Ensemble of Chicago's funk-drenched composition, Theme de Yo-Yo, jazz and funk have always been intertwined. We're hoping that the music inspires you to support this effort by visiting WPFWFM.org to make a tax-deductible secure donation to our relocation fund. That's Jazz is the Teacher, Funk is the Preacher, Saturday and Sunday, April 6th and 7th, from midnight to midnight. WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, WPFW. Festival season is here, which means good music, good food, and good people. The 8th annual Words, Beats, and Life Festival kicks the season off with events from April 1st through 7th in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Featured artists include a special evening with Saul Williams, April 5th at Woolly Mammoth Theater, Sunken Cages, Dragon Child, and Faraway Ghost at Millennium Stage, April 4th, Diggable Planets, Sun Ra Orchestra, and more at the Jazz and Blossoms Park Jam, April 7th. Plus, poetry slams, a hip-hop education conference, and free dance workshops all week. To learn more about all the events, visit wblinc.org/WBLFest.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. A second temporary channel accessing the Port of Baltimore was opened yesterday, and a third, deeper channel is under construction. The channels are primarily meant to grant access to vessels involved in the cleanup of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge, though some boats that have been stuck in the port will also use them. Maryland Governor Wes Moore said rough weather in recent days has hampered the cleanup effort. State lawmakers held a hearing yesterday afternoon on a bill authorizing the release of emergency funds to assist port employees out of work due to the bridge collapse. A state Senate committee advanced the bill yesterday, and the full Senate could hold a vote as soon as today. Voters in Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, and Wisconsin held presidential primaries yesterday, and President Biden and former President Trump easily won their respective races in all four states. The primaries did, however, offer an opportunity for Democrats to issue a protest vote over Biden's support for Israel's war in Gaza. In Wisconsin, a protest campaign far exceeded its goal of 20,000 uncommitted votes, winning more than 47,000 in the key swing state. That's roughly equivalent to 8% of the vote. Activists say they hope the protest effort will send Biden's administration a message that he cannot take their votes for granted in the critical battleground state. The bodies of six humanitarian workers killed by an Israeli strike on Monday night were transported out of Gaza and into Egypt today, ahead of their repatriation. The killed aid workers include three British citizens, a Polish citizen, an Australian, and a Canadian-American dual citizen. A Palestinian man driving the workers was also killed, and his remains were given to his family for burial in Gaza. In acknowledging the attack, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it, quote, a tragic case of our forces unintentionally hitting innocent people. The Israeli military, which has killed thousands of innocent people, including children in Gaza, said it is conducting a thorough review into the incident. The World Central Kitchen charity, whose workers were killed on Monday night, was founded by celebrity chef Jose Andres, who said in a statement on social media, quote, the Israeli government needs to stop this indiscriminate killing. It needs to stop restricting humanitarian aid, stop killing civilians and aid workers, and stop using food as a weapon. World Central Kitchen said it is pausing operations immediately in the region and will be making decisions about the future of its work in the region soon. At least three other aid organizations have paused or are considering pausing operations following Monday night's attack. According to the United Nations, more than 200 humanitarian aid workers have died since the war began in October. And at least 9 people were killed and over 900 injured this morning when a major earthquake struck eastern Taiwan. The earthquake was measured at 7.4 magnitude by the U.S. Geological Survey and was felt as far away as Shanghai and China's southeastern provinces. A tsunami warning was triggered but later lifted. The quake and its aftershocks caused one building to completely collapse, and at least 100 buildings have been damaged, according to local officials, though the full extent of the damage is still being assessed. At least 24 landslides have been reported, as well as damage to dozens of roads, bridges, and tunnels. At least 70 people are trapped in rock quarries. Taiwan sits on the Pacific Ring of Fire, a region of the Pacific Ocean that is home to most of the world's earthquakes. Today's quake was the strongest to hit Taiwan in 25 years. In 1999, a 7.6 magnitude earthquake struck central Taiwan, killing more than 2,400 people. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 51 degrees with rain.